So we are going to finish up Nehemiah tonight. As I am sure you all remember, we got through chapter 9 last time. Chapter 9, as you will remember, was a prayer of confession, very much like Daniel chapter 9. They all confessed their sins and the sins of the nation. And I'm down at 9:38, which is where we finished last time. Because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing on the sealed documents are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. So what they're going to do is they're going to make a written covenant with God. And I am not going to read the whole thing. That's the first 27 verses of chapter 10 is a list of all the names that sign it. I'm going to skip down then to 10:28, which lays out the obligations of the covenant that they signed. It is things that are in the Torah with a couple of additions, if you will, but basically it's the Torah. So verse 28, the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and all who have separated themselves from the people of the lands to the law of God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, all who have knowledge and understanding, join with their brothers, their nobles, and enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God and his rules and his statutes. So they are obviously confirming the Torah as given at Mount Sinai. What isn't clear here is whether or not they recited it or it was read to them as a congregation kind of thing. Sort of like God talked to them at Sinai. He had everybody standing there at Sinai and started to talk. And so the idea here is all of these people are there and are agreeing to the covenant. So verse 30. We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring in goods or any grains on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day, and we will forego the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. So it's affirming the Sabbath with a bit more specificity than the Torah has. Certainly in Deuteronomy, Moses tells Israel, when you go into the land, I want you to wipe out everybody. I don't want you to marry them. I don't want you to do anything with them. I want them all dead. Of course, they don't do that and wind up getting entangled with the locals. And so they're confirming, if you will, the end of the set of instructions Moses gave to Joshua. Since we have been through Jeremiah, you'll remember that one of the reasons that they got sent into exile in the first place was they weren't observing the seventh year sabbatical of the land, and they weren't releasing debts at the end of 7 years. And that's one of the big reasons God sent them into exile. And as you know, the number of years of exile were equivalent to the number of Sabbaths that Israel owed the land. They had not been doing the Shemitah year for 490 years, and they owed the land 70 of those Sabbaths. So God says, you won't do it while you're here, so I'll just get you out of the way and let the land do it by itself. So what they're confirming here is we will do it. And we'll try and avoid getting thrown out of here again. We'll get down to the end of the book and we'll find out that they aren't doing this stuff. All of this firm resolve doesn't last very long at all. And at the end of Nehemiah, we'll see what all that looks like. But the other thing about this is one of the things that's going on with the Pharisees and Yeshua is something that is very near and dear to them is to not get sent back into exile. So they've got this guy wandering around, pretending to be the Messiah, in their view, and last thing they want to do is have the Romans come down on him. In other words, they don't want him to be able to stir up a rebellion against Rome, which is something the Messiah would do. And if this guy isn't the real deal, stirring up a rebellion against Rome is going to get us sent back into exile. So that's one of the big things that the Pharisees have against Yeshua. They don't see him as a legitimate Messiah, and they don't want him becoming so popular that he is able to raise an army and go after the Romans because they don't think they can win. That's all as a result of having come back out of Babylon and recognize, all right, this is why we went in, so we're going to make sure that we don't do that again. And their resolve actually doesn't last very long, but that's what's going on here. Verse 32, we also take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God, for the showbread, the regular grain offering, the regular burnt offering, the Sabbaths, the new moons, the appointed feasts, the holy things, the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel, and for all the work of the house of our God. Now, what does Moses say the census tax is? Half shekel. Well, we'll do a third. But the census tax, if you will, was half a shekel. And the thing is, they're not poor because they brought back scads of loot out of Babylon that was given both to Ezra and to Nehemiah. So there's a bunch of money floating around. And one of the things about Nehemiah is he does not take the governor's tax from the people. We read earlier that as the governor here, I could exact a tax from the people to support myself and my staff. He didn't do that. He paid for that out of his own pocket. So it's not like they're being overtaxed and a third of a shekel is the best they can do. The comment was earlier on, they were poor because the wealthy ones were doing usury. Nehemiah stopped that. And furthermore, he made the rich ones pay back the interest that they had exacted from their brothers. We're in verse 34. We, the priests, the Levites, and the people, have likewise cast lots for the wood offering, to bring it into the house of our God according to our fathers' houses at times appointed year by year, to burn on the altar of the Lord our God as it is written in the law. There isn't anything special about a wood offering in the Torah. It makes sense, don't get me wrong. Somebody's got to show up with all the wood that gets consumed burning sacrifices. But it is not specifically mentioned in the Torah. And so the assumption there is the temple tax would take care of that. That would be one of the things that the temple tax would cover, getting wood and that kind of thing. Verse 35. We obligate ourselves to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all fruit of every tree year by year to the house of the Lord. Also to bring to the house of our God, to the priests who minister to the house of our God, the firstborn of our sons and of our cattle, as it is written in the law, and the firstborn of our herds and our flocks, and to bring the first of our dough and our contributions, the fruit of every tree, the wine and the oil to the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and to bring to the Levites the tithes from our ground. For it is the Levites who collect the tithes in all our towns where we labor. So they're going to do what they're supposed to be doing as far as first fruits, tithes, redeeming their children, all those kinds of things. Those are all in Moses. 38, and the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites receive the tithes. And the Levite shall bring up the tithe of the tithes to the house of our God, to the chambers of the storehouse. This is again Moses. The idea is the people bring in 10% to the Levites, and that covers the gatekeepers and the singers and the ones that butcher the animals and all that kind of stuff. And a tenth then of the tithe that goes to the Levites goes from the Levites to the priests, and that supports the priests. This is straight Torah 101. Verse 39. For the people of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of grain, wine, and oil to the chambers where the vessels of the sanctuary are, as well as the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and the singers, we will not neglect the house of our God. Now, chapter 11, I am going to skip over, except the first couple of verses. Now, the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. So the deal here is Jerusalem has not been rebuilt as a city. You got the temple and you got the wall. And houses for everybody and all that kind of stuff haven't been built yet. Everybody is living in the suburbs around Jerusalem. So what they're doing is they're going to cast lots and say 1 out of 10, you're moving into Jerusalem, which means that we got to build houses and those kinds of things. In other words, we need to make Jerusalem a going concern as opposed to a museum piece. In addition to that, verse 2, and the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. So some people, instead of waiting for the lot to be cast upon them, said, hey, yeah, I'll go live in Jerusalem. And everybody said, oh, cool, that means I don't have to. Or words of that effect in Hebrew, or Aramaic. And it means disrupting your whole household and moving. It's a chore. And so if people volunteer for it as opposed to being drafted for it, that's a blessing. So verse 3, all the way down to the end of chapter 11, are genealogies. Who are the gatekeepers and who run the overseer of the Levites and all that kind of stuff. And then we have, starting in 25, a list of the villages around Jerusalem where people live. And again, I am not going to read all those. So that takes us down to chapter 12. These are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, Seraiah, and so forth. All right, again, we have a list of names, and then a list of Levites' names, and so forth. Now let's go all the way down to verse 27, which is where the narrative picks up again. And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, with thanksgiving, and with singing, with cymbals, harps, and lyres. So they're going to have a big celebration once the wall is finished and the gates are set, bringing everybody into town for the occasion. Verse 28, and the sons of the singers gathered together from the district surrounding Jerusalem and from the villages of the Netophathites, also from Beth Gilgal, and from the region of Geba and Asmavea. For the singers have built for themselves villages around Jerusalem. And the priests and the Levites purified themselves, and they purified the people and the gates and the wall. So they have formally dedicated it and brought everybody in town for the big celebration. Verse 31. Then I brought the leaders of Judah up onto the wall and appointed 2 great choirs that gave thanks. One went to the south on the wall to the Dung Gate, and after them went Hoshaiah and half of the leaders of Judah, and Azariah, Ezra, Mishalim, Judah, Benjamin, Shemaiah, Jeremiah, certain of the priest's sons with trumpets, Zechariah, the son of Jonathan, the son of Asaph, and his relatives, and so forth. So what they're doing is they're going to have these 2 great choirs on the wall, and they've divided the leadership between the two. So you got half the leadership on one and half on the other. And they're going to obviously sing as part of the celebration. Now, what would really be cool, or I have no idea whether they did it or not, is whether they did it call and response. One would call and the other one would respond. I think that would be really cool. I don't know what they did. The purpose of having them separated is you can sing antiphonally. And I just think that would be cool. And if nothing else, God does what I think is cool. So down to 37. And at the fountain gate, they went up straight before them by the stairs of the city of David at the ascent of the wall above the house of David to the water gate on the east. And for those of you who have been in Jerusalem, the walls have a walkway around them, obviously constructed for defensive purposes. In other words, there's no point in having a wall if you can't fight from it. So they have a walkway that goes along the wall. The walkway is about chest high below the crest. So what they're doing is they're getting these 2 choirs up on that walkway to sing back and forth. 38. The other choir of those who gave thanks went to the north, and I followed them with half the people, on the wall above the Tower of the Ovens, to the broad wall, and above the gate of Ephraim, by the gate of Yeshaniah, and by the fish gate, and the Tower of Hananiel, and the Tower of the Hundred, and to the sheep gate, and they came to a halt at the gate of the guard. So both choirs of those who gave thanks stood in the house of God, and I and half the officials with me, and the priests Eliakim, Maaseiah, Menahem, Micaiah, Elioenai, Zechariah, and Hananiah with trumpets. And so they've got choirs, trumpets, and they've also got a choir going in the temple. So singing all over the place. Skip some names. And the singers sang with Jeremiah as their leader. And they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, and the joy of Jerusalem was heard far away. Verse 44. On that day, men were appointed over the storerooms, the contributions, the firstfruits, and the tithes. Gather into them the portions required by the law for the priests and for the Levites according to the fields of the town. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and the Levites who ministered. And they performed the service of their God and the sacrifice of purification, as did the singers and the gatekeepers, according to the command of David and his son Solomon. So remember, David laid out the courses of the priests and the singers and all those guys. One of the reasons all these genealogies are important, these courses of priests and Levites and so forth, still exist at the time of Yeshua. That's one of the ways that we can determine that Yeshua was not born on Christmas, because Elizabeth's husband was of the order of, I think, Abijah, and they served at a certain time. He's in the temple doing the duties of a priest and gets visited by an angel, and the angel says, "You're going to have a son." Then strikes him dumb. So he comes out there and he can't say a word. And everybody looks at him and says, "Ooh, wow, something must have happened in there." He goes home, and one assumes that he and Elizabeth renew their acquaintance, and John is conceived. So when Mary conceives by the Holy Spirit, she goes and visits Elizabeth, and it specifically says Elizabeth is at that point 6 months pregnant. And Elizabeth 6 months pregnant would have been probably in December. So 9 months later, you get to Sukkot the next year when the Messiah is born. So these long lists of genealogies become important not only to Jews but to Christians. They are, however, not of much use for this study. 46. For long ago in the days of David and Asaph, there were directors of the singers, and there were songs of praise and thanksgiving to God. And all Israel in the days of Zerubbabel, in the days of Nehemiah, gave the daily portions for the singers and the gatekeepers, and they set apart that which was for the Levites, and the Levites set apart that which was for the sons of Aaron. So everything's up and running. You got tithes coming in, got people over the various storehouses, and everything is organized. Now down to chapter 13. On that day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and in it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God, for they did not meet the people of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. Yet our God turned the curse into a blessing. As soon as the people heard the law, they separated from Israel all those of foreign descent. So they're still got mixed marriages going on. Verse 4. Now, before this, Eliashib, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah. Now, remember I told you when we saw Tobiah several chapters back, remember this guy because he's going to show up again. And here he is. Tobiah is an Ammonite. And Tobiah, as you remember, was heavily involved in efforts to discourage Nehemiah from building the wall, to the extent of sending letters back to the king of Persia. So he has been an enemy of Nehemiah's all this time. According to the text, he tried to meet Nehemiah outside of Jerusalem several times, And Nehemiah was warned, he intends to do you harm. If you go out and meet this guy, you're not coming back. So that's Tobiah. Now verse 4 again. Now before this, Eliashib, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah, prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offering, the frankincense, the vessels, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, which were given by the commandment to the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contributions of the priests. So what he's done is he has taken a storeroom in the temple, cleared it out, and made an apartment for Tobiah. So verse 6, while this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. So what happened was Nehemiah left town and went back to Persia to check in with the king. So he's been gone for some period of time. So verse 6, while this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king, and after some time, I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem. And I then discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. There's got to be something going on between these two, because Tobiah has been a steadfast opponent of building the wall and reestablishing Jerusalem. So for him to get an apartment in there, something is going on. I'm at verse 8. And I was very angry. And I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleaned the chamber, and I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. So Nehemiah gets back in town, and you can imagine these domestic relationship movies where stuff comes flying out of the second story window. That's the image I have here. Verse 10. I also found out that the portion of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field. So they have gone to all this trouble to set up tithing and so forth. They've set up a system to administer it, and he discovers that the rations for the singers had not been given to them. So the singers had to go back to their fields in order to survive. And I've got to think that this is all part of the Tobiah incident, if you will. Because remember, one of the things that Tobiah is given is a room that is used for storage of tithes and other things. So I'm assuming that all of this is going on, and probably at the behest of Eliashib, who is a priest. So 10 again. I also found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled each to his field. So I confronted the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. In other words, he grabbed them by the stacking swivel and put them where he wanted them. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and oil into the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouse Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Pedaiah of the Levites, and as their assistant Hanan, the son of Zakur, son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and their duty was to distribute to their brothers. They are quartermasters, if you will. They are responsible for accepting, storing, and giving out as appropriate. Apparently, the giving out part had not been happening. Verse 14. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for his service. A couple of things. Obviously, Nehemiah is seriously ticked about what was going on. And what he's saying here is there's two reasons to be ticked. They're not mutually exclusive. Reason number one is I told you to do this and you didn't do it. I'm ticked. Reason number two is the thing I told you to do was for God. So I'm ticked on his behalf. Those are intertwined emotions, shall we say. This remember me for good is I am looking after your interests here, God. Please remember that. 15. So, continuing to find things that are wrong. In those days I saw in Judah people treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys, and also wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them on the day when they sold food. Tyrians also, who lived in the city, brought in fish. Tyre, you remember, is on the seacoast. So Tyrians are trading back and forth. Tyrians also, who lived in the city, brought in fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the people of Judah, in Jerusalem itself. Exclamation point. Then I confronted the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not our fathers act in this way, and did not our God bring all this evil on us and on this city? Now you are bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." Remember, they all started back here in the covenant that they all made that they weren't going to profane the Sabbath. And as soon as the sheriff gets out of town, everybody's coming into town on the Sabbath and doing business. 19. As soon as it began to grow dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and gave orders that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. You guys won't do this voluntarily, so we'll fix it. I have built this really wonderful wall. It's impregnable. It's got great gates. We're going to use them. They gave orders that they should not be open till after the Sabbath, and I stationed some of my servants at the gate that no load might be brought in on the Sabbath day. In other words, I don't even trust the people who are supposed to be doing this. I put my own people on the gate to make sure that they didn't get opened. Then the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. They all showed up in Jerusalem expecting to be able to get in, and so they camped there overnight and waited for the Sabbath to be over so they could go in the next day. Then the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, but I warned them and I said to them, "Why do you lodge outside the wall? If you do it again, I'll lay hands on you." From that time on, they did not come at the Sabbath. 22. Then I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come and guard the gates to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember this also in my favor, O my God, and spare me according to the greatness of your steadfast love. In those days I also saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they did not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. So we're still dealing with this mixed marriage. He's had foreign wives put away now. This is the third time. And I don't know whether these are people who got missed the first two rounds or they just kept going back to the Midianite babes. We're back in Ezra here. The comment was that the leadership of Israel has married foreign wives and the people of Israel as well. And the idea here is if the leaders had stayed pure, perhaps others would have as well. So back to Nehemiah 13. Pick it up at 23 again. In those days, I also saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves." Obviously, really, really upset. 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? This is again speculation. I suspect that as he got these people together and says you got to get rid of them, some of them were snarky back to him and refused to do it. I suspect those are the ones who got beaten, as opposed to the ones who said, "Oh, yeah, sure," and stepped up and did what they were supposed to do. 28. One of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Now Sanballat was the co-conspirator with Tobiah. And we have one of the priests here is the son-in-law of Sanballat. Therefore I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. So not only have they not done what I told them to do, but they are disobeying you as well, God. Thus I cleansed them from everything foreign, and I established the duties of the priests and the Levites, each to his work, and I provided for the wood offering at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Nehemiah ends there, but I don't think the saga does end there. I think that this continues to happen. And the fact that it's happening here in Nehemiah shows how tempting that kind of stuff can be. So there we have the end of Ezra and Nehemiah, which is the story of the return from the Babylonian exile.